To the rest of the country, it's always summer in Hawaii, but it's in summer that many families and other visitors arrive on Hawaii's shores. The condition of those shores on Maui and Kauai were tested recently this month by the Surfrider Foundation's Blue Water Task Force. Stuart Coleman is the foundation's Hawaii coordinator, and we called him to get some comparison of the results, at least so far. Aloha, Stuart.
Aloha, Bethann.
So we saw that Kauai and Maui were tested by the Blue Water Task Force. What about Oahu? Is that being tested now?
You know, we are revamping the Blue Water Task Force for Oahu and also doing a much bigger in-depth study of water quality around the island.
So how will that compare to the way it's been done in past?
You know, the we are working with the EPA, and we're testing each shore. We'll have test sites on the north, east, west, and south shores. And we're looking for more than just, bacteria testing for, human fecal matter. But we're looking also for, we've got like over 100 pollutants that we're going to be kind of trying to trace and figure out the worst offenders. And maybe possible sources of where they're coming from.
When you talk about some of those worst offenders in the report that we saw from this month that that you produced for Kauai, that showed pretty high bacterial content of the Enterococcus for 15 of the 31 sites. If you're now shifting how you're looking at Hawaii, how do you make the entire report and the way that we're asked to look at the islands consistent with each other?
You know, we're going to be using the same methods for the Blue Water Task Force, so it'll be very much the same, and it's the same that DOH is currently using it that the EPA mandates. But this other test is apart from that, and so that'll be looking into other sources of pollution. And it's important to remember the two biggest sources of water pollution in Hawaii, and in particular, and then across the country, are stormwater runoff. And we helped pass a bill that allows the counties to do more kind of green infrastructure to capture that. Because what most people don't realize is that after every heavy rain, all that water just collects all the pollutants from pesticides and herbicides and from farms and yards to oils and heavy metals and gas and pet waste, and it goes all into the storm drains and into the ocean. So that's the number one source. The secondary source is, in Hawaii in particular, is from cesspools, because we have the highest number of cesspools in the country, and more than 90,000. But the good news is that we've worked with the legislature, and we're expanding and increasing the tax break that allows homeowners to upgrade their cesspools to a septic or aerobic treatment unit, or even hook up to sewer. And so that's expected to be passed and signed by the governor soon.
As you have these other efforts moving forward, though, how would you encourage people to look at the report that we've just seen from the Blue Water Task Force, both on Maui, which looked much better than Kauai, but especially for Kauai?
Yeah, it's. I think the most important thing is that the Blue Water Task Force is done by volunteers. They're all volunteers working with the Surfrider Foundation who take time out to sample these areas that are, either directly in the ocean or stream mouths right before the ocean. And Kauai happens, even though we think of it, it's very ironic, as the most pristine island in terms of, development and not as much of a population. They have a lot of cesspools, and they're near rivers that carry it down and leach into the waterways. And And so one of the things we're really trying to emphasize, and we've been working with the Department of Health and the Clean Water Branch, is posting signs. And so some of your listeners might have seen new signs that are being posted around, and then also doing better public notification of educating locals and tourists about why it's important to know before you go, basically to know what the water quality is, so that after a heavy rain, we just really want to make it common sense knowledge that you don't want to go out into the water, and especially anywhere near a river mouth, within at least 24 to 48 hours.
You mentioned the Department of Health and the Clean Water Branch. It also obviously is doing testing, as you are also saying that the trying to make what the Blue Water Task Force is doing in some ways consistent with the Department of Health. How then do you compare some of those numbers as they've, you know, not necessarily been as consistent, and given the changes that we've seen with the EPA and other changes that may come down, are you also concerned that all of these testing may not necessarily be supported by the EPA as we go forward?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest threat right now is that the Trump administration is threatening to, cut off almost all funding for UHC grant, with whom we're partnering, and for the Beach Act, which gives, all these coastal communities across the country the primary funds they need to do this water quality testing work. So, water quality was something that Surf Rider was founded on, that and beach access. But it was kind of a somewhat lesser issue over the years, until literally in the last 3 years, it's become one of the top issues that everybody is concerned about and talking about. So it's been kind of elevated, and now that it's in threat of being cut off, we're really worried about losing funding for these operations.
Are you already starting to consider a contingency plan if, in fact, some of that funding goes away? Clearly, Hawaii is very dependent upon its water quality, and not just for tourists.
Yeah, exactly. And the case in Flint, Michigan, really kind of brought home how important our water quality is. And so one of the things we're doing is we have an action alert. If you go to surfrider.org, you can sign up to petition the government to say, look, we have to restore funding to the EPA and for these environmental programs. This isn't partisan. This is just pure protection of the environment, which we all depend on. So, that's something we're doing nationally and regionally and locally. And it also brings home the need that we do need these citizen science efforts, even for small nonprofits like the Surf Rider, with our volunteers just doing the citizen science, becoming more aware in case the funding is cut.
Are you actively looking for more volunteers to be able to go out and test more sites around Oahu in particular?
We are. We're ramping up the Blue Water Task Force just in case, like I said, the funding is cut, and we've got an amazing team of dedicated volunteers who are going to, start going around the island collecting samples and analyzing them to supplement what the Department of Health is doing, but also in case some of their funding is cut. And it's also to enforce what DOH was doing, because they were working with them, but they weren't posting signs and in polluted areas and doing public notification. But they've made a lot of big strides to improving that.
It seems that you're trying to bring together a lot of these efforts to ensure that they can continue. But as you talk about, citizen scientists going out there and collecting the samples, all of the testing, though, will be standardized, I take it, and so that way it will be reliable information?
Absolutely, yeah. So we're working with the Department of Health's Clean Water Branch, and we have a quality assurance program that is in line with them, and we've been working. That's partly why it's taken so long, that we're just trying to do it exactly the same and make sure that it's 100% reliable.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing those results that come back from Oahu, and thanks very much for giving us some time today.
Mahalo, Beth Ann. Thanks for sharing this important issue.
Stuart Coleman is the Hawaii coordinator for the Surf Rider Foundation. The Blue Water Task Force is the Surf Rider Foundation's volunteer-run water testing, education, and advocacy program. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, keeping the soul jazz tradition alive. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
We just heard about the Surf Rider Foundation's efforts to monitor water quality using a force of volunteers around the country. So in today's backyard quiz, we look to a moment in Hawaii's history that affects our environment to this day. On this date, 45 years ago, Lieutenant Governor William Richardson became the state's first Hawaiian, or even part Hawaiian, to serve as Chief Justice since the monarchy. During his tenure from 1966 to 1982, Hawaii's population more than doubled and commercial development accelerated. Richardson handed down a series of land use judgments that were unique among the 50 United States. Can you name at least two of them? And can you tell us why they were so controversial? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know, and we'll have those answers later in the program.
Aloha, I'm Ed Ebisui. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The new Master Sounds from Leeds, England, are neo-traditionalists with a name that harkens back to one of the groundbreaking American electric jazz groups of the 1950s. The sound owes as much to soul music and rhythm and blues as it does to classic jazz. They're in Hawaii to perform in Waikiki, and their guitarist, Eddie Roberts, is with us in our studio. Eddie, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You came from a music scene in Leeds that really celebrated a certain era of American music, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It was mainly DJs playing in clubs, playing funk 45s and soul jazz and Latin music, things like that. And we started hanging out in those clubs, and they started making cassettes for us, you know. And so that's kind of how we'd learned all this tradition.
So you learned from what was popular in the clubs, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it wasn't a mainstream club by any means, but you know, every Friday or Saturday night there'd be about 400 people dancing to jazz, funk, and soul. So yeah, it's a pretty cool scene.
What was the heyday of this era for you? I mean, what was the music that was most inspiring?
Well, you know, pretty much the '60s, you know, and into the early '70s. I cut off around 1974, I think.
Yeah. So we're talking about guitarists like Wes Montgomery, Grant Green.
Yeah, absolutely. Grant Green, probably my favorite of the bunch. George Benson, before he started singing.
Uh-huh. Right.
And yeah, those guys.
A lot of that original sound, the so-called soul jazz sound, came from Philadelphia because. I feel like a Hammond organ salesman went through the Philadelphia area and sold about 100 of them to little nightclubs around that area.
That makes sense.
But the sound of the Hammond organ, the electric guitar, and drums was a big...
Yeah, yeah. And my first band actually was the Three Deuces, and that was exactly that, B3, drums and guitar. And I just, you know, the first time I heard the guitar with the B3, it just seemed to suit each other. It just complements each other. And, you know, sometimes like a Fender Rhodes is almost too similar to the sound of the guitar. And,
yeah.
And it kind of gets a bit confusing, but the B3 and the guitar just marry so well together.
They're like soup and crackers.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the B3 and the bass is coming from the foot pedals on the B3, so mm-hmm. so you know, from the top to bottom of frequencies, a Hammond organ has given you just this huge wash of sound.
Mm-hmm.
The guitar seems to be the ideal way to cut through that.
Right, right, absolutely, yeah.
But it has to be sort of played in a way that cuts through as well.
Yeah, it's kind
it?
Of a percussive way to play, you know, I think, you know, when, rather than like a overdriven sound, which would just add to the muddy wash as well.
Yeah.
Know? So you've got to have that, that kind of more percussive and clean sound.
Then you have, in that kind of band, you also have a rhythmic approach that owes a great deal to what? To say, I think of James Brown and mm-hmm. bands like that have that kind of sound.
Oh yeah, I mean you've got to take some of James Brown, you know, in whatever you play, really. In my opinion,
take Brown with you wherever you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you folks just did a little live warm up in our studio just mm-hmm. About an hour or so ago. Let's listen to just a little bit of that, and we'll talk some more after cool. we've heard it. And that was the new Master Sounds, recorded all of, what, 45 minutes ago?
Something like that. Yeah.
Pretty good for before lunch.
I know. I was going to say it's a little bit early to be playing.
But great energy in that, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, yeah. That's actually a brand new tune of ours called "Green Was Beautiful," which is a homage to Grant Green. Like I said, my favorite guitar player, and it's, you know, got that kind of sound to it. Although obviously we didn't have a B3 in the studio, so
yeah,
the piano's replaced it on this one.
Yeah, it sounded terrific though, and it you know, it's based as with so much of soul jazz, it's based on a vamp that gives you lots of room to take off and improvise.
Sure, 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 yeah.
What makes for sort of an ideal tune for improvisation for you? What do you like to have going on behind you?
I like this kind of pace, you know. I like this kind of speed. It suits the way I play, and you know. And I like minor vamps as well. You know, if you get too majory and too happy clappy, I'm not. You know, I'm too miserable for that, I think.
Yeah, very very major sounds can you can get sappy without intending to.
Yeah, absolutely,
can't
yeah.
you? But yeah. No such danger in a minor key.
Yeah,
but then there's a whole idea of developing a solo, you know, over a repetitive cycle. It puts a lot of weight on the soloist in a way to take it somewhere.
Yeah, that's true, and you know, and you try and do that, you know, with not just the notes, but with the rhythm that you play as well.
Yeah.
Know? And try and mix that up and just create interest, create movement. Yeah.
How many gigs a year are you folks doing now?
Last year was a big year for us. We did around 120 shows just in the U.S. alone. This year we're taking it a little easier. We'll, you know, with this band, I'll probably play about 60 shows. But then I'm the only one who actually lives in the States now. So I'm playing with a lot of, you know, different people, side projects, and I've been playing with the guys from the Meters and some of my other heroes.
So. Everybody's dream rhythm section.
Yeah,
right?
can't complain.
Yeah, well, when a band plays together that often, what kind of things happen in terms of your interplay?
Well, I mean that is the beauty. We've been together 18 years, and. There is an element of ESP really that starts happening when, you know, we can jam things out. We can go to different sections. We can drop into different grooves. We can do it with a nod and a wink, you know, and all of a sudden we've gone somewhere else and we're all together and everyone knows where we are, you know. It's quite a privilege.
That is an accomplishment, because it is tricky to do in an art form that demands that you not repeat yourself.
Yeah, I mean that is one of the most exciting parts of it. And you know, you can't replicate just time spent on the road together on stage together.
Yeah. Well, it's the time on the bandstand. It's those other times that are that's what you've got to get paid for.
Yeah, exactly. That's I always say that. Yeah, you get paid for hanging around.
Yeah, schlepping those amps up onto the stage, dealing with that. Eddie, thanks very much for talking.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, pleasure. Eddie Roberts is the guitarist for the new Master Sounds. The quartet will perform at Blue Note Hawaii this week, Thursday through Saturday.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Achieve 3000, helping strengthen the school-home connection with Home Edition, an online tool with reading and writing tailored to each student's ability. Achieve3000.com/HawaiiParents.
Hawaii's counties are digesting the legislative session, and one issue not going down well with any of them is the lack of protection for lifeguards. The bill, which would have made the support permanent, failed despite only one voice in opposition, but it was a very loud voice. CivilBeat.org reporter Nathan Eagle has a reality check. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, I guess pretty well, unless maybe you're a lifeguard looking at this and wondering why. Now, lifeguards have had limited liability immunity for, what, the last 15 years, but this current protection is going to be sunsetting pretty soon on June 30th. Nathan, what's going to happen to lifeguards then?
Well, they're kind of feeling their way forward. I mean, it's like you said, it's been 15 years since 2002 that they've had this protection. So the counties are researching the ramifications. They're exploring the idea of buying insurance. They're looking at maybe having the county councils pass legislation. They're really just feeling their way forward right now.
Does this also mean that we might see fewer lifeguards?
At this point, no, it doesn't, fortunately. They said that, you know, despite losing this protection on June 30th, they're going to keep going to work. They're going to keep doing that. Earlier, they had threatened to maybe pull the guards from some of the beaches that would be losing that protection.
You mentioned that the counties are trying to feel their way and come up with something that might be able to protect the guards better. But how do you reconcile that with already the sort of the disadvantaged position that the counties feel with regard to the state?
It's really tough. I mean, they are in a tough position. It wasn't just this liability issue that they've kind of taken some hits on, but also they're going to have a little less revenue, too, going forward, since the state also is cutting by $10 million the amount of hotel tax revenue they're getting.
And that sort of brings up the point, then, if that's the case, how can the counties then afford to go and purchase additional insurance for the lifeguards?
It's a wide open question. I think that's probably why they're looking at legislation now instead.
And if they were to pass legislation, how would that be able to protect them differently than perhaps what we're seeing from the state? Or would it be virtually the same thing?
My guess is it would be the same, but it's just that. It's a guess at this point. They're still definitely researching it. They're consulting all their attorneys and trying to just take stock of what happened.
Is there any timeline on this that the mayors and the counties will get together and have some sort of answers? It's getting close to June 30th, only roughly a month away.
It's getting really close, and they are. They're trading emails, they're trading phone calls. HGEA, the union that represents the guards, is sending out letters now to all the counties trying to see what they can do. So, yeah, it's definitely urgent.
Okay, so we'll wait and see if we can get the next conversation about this one going, because this one's been a real burr under the saddle of the counties. And clearly, every time we've talked to the counties during our county council check-ins over the last couple of weeks, this is the one issue that especially has come up with a lot of rancor. Thanks a whole lot.
You're welcome.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org. Today, featuring reporter Nathan Eagle. This week, an analysis of consumer household debt by the Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism put Hawaii second in the nation. Per capita, Hawaii households carry a little over $67,000 in overall debt and about $46,000 in mortgage debt. Now, that might not make much sense to anyone with a mortgage in Hawaii unless the words per capita are highlighted. We called Hawaii real estate analyst Ricky Cassaday for a fuller explanation of how to read the report.
Yeah, when you look at, you compare the total overall credit versus the mortgage component of that credit, it screams at you that Hawaiians are bearing a greater burden off of the mortgage, much of which would be tied to price. And that's in relation to the rest of the United States, whose home prices are a lot lower than ours. So, I mean, that kind of makes sense. If you have to dig underneath it, then you have to ask, do we have two income earners on the mortgage? And that makes sense to me, because at the same time, we have such a high component of debt per capita. But we're also one of the lowest wages states in the country. So the juxtaposition between only earning a little and having to spend a lot is what is impressive to me, or makes me think.
What's the average mortgage in Hawaii?
I don't know, but I did a blended average the other day of just the price of a house and calculated to see, you know, what it was a long time ago and where it is now. But I, as far as the average mortgage, I'd have to dig into the report for a second and see if there's a number there. The number that I had, though, was, you know, 30 years ago, actually longer than that. Number I had was that in 1980, the blended average the price index for houses in Hawaii was $135,000. And in 2016, the blended average is $746,000. And by blended, I mean single-family condos, new and resale homes, just all everything that was sold. So that's up 500%. The actual, and I'm just talking about figuring that you guys can cut into this and cut out of this. The mortgage that they're calling out here in terms of off the $67,000 average annual wage is $51,000. So they say 77% of our debt is consumed by a mortgage relative to 68% on the mainland.
And again, that's per capita. But when people look at some of these numbers and think, wait a second, I bought a house and it was $600,000, you know, maybe if that person put down $200,000, they're still carrying a $400,000 mortgage, and total debt encompasses your mortgage too. So in some ways, is this report a little disingenuous for people to be able to look at and try to rate themselves?
Yeah, I'd be careful about rating yourself off of this. But on the other hand, I would lean forward and encourage everybody, instead of trying to see their own particular interest in something like this, I'd see the whole interest and see it, because you're getting a pretty good vision of our entire community, from the rich to the poor, everybody in between. And then when you throw us up against the mainland, you really do see we are different. We are special, as my children will sometimes say to me. And that's the fact of Hawaii. That is, we are... Everything we do is because we're special relative to client, aloha spirit, duty, cost, and so on and so forth.
When people have mortgages, very often they are told by their financial advisors that it may be advantageous just to not pay off the mortgage, even if they can, because they can write off the mortgage interest from their taxes. Is that a strategy that you think holds a great deal of water, or is there a downside to that that you think we don't talk about enough when we talk about how much debt we carry?
Well, most people, when they look at average debt and averages this, averages that, they love to compare the average mortgage cost of ownership versus the cost of rentership, and in a lot of cases, the mortgage deduction and some of the other things balance it out. So I've heard and I've read conflicting reports. No, in Hawaii you should do this. Own, no, you should rent. And I've been reading rent more than own lately. But the component that is really interesting to me that makes Hawaii special is a couple things. One, the drive to own your home, starting from the leasehold system that was broke in the 60s when New Valley was first converted from fee simple from leasehold. That whole eras and generations of people wanting to own their land, and when they did it, they got a piece of the rock and rode the appreciation. You know, for instance, when Bishop Estate converted Hawaii Kai. So I bring this up because the other part of the report that dovetailed with this a little was the last page when they said, you know, our home equity component of debt was highest in the nation and highest by a lot. And what that brought to mind was the fact that we have a lot of people out here that use their homes as a bank. This is where they go to put their kids through school or meet extraordinary expenses. And when they do that, again, looking at the totality of our community, when they do that, they have to figure out ways to make more money. And if they're on a wage, then they're not really capable to increase their income. just off of that. They might have to get into a business that, that has something else like tips. So gray market marijuana, all that stuff, is also extra money that helps them feed the meter when they tacked on a mortgage or when they tacked on a home equity loan. And you can see other manifestations of this behavior when they rent their house out short-term to VRBO or vacation rentals. That's extra money. It's sound money. It helps to subsidize and to support their life.
If they're using their homes as banks, though, long-term, not necessarily for short-term rentals, but just saying this is a good investment, it's probably the biggest investment that average people make is their home. But is there also something that you would caution them against in looking at the home as a bank for later on when perhaps they don't have the same level of income? And it might mean that, A, they're going to spend a lot more money to be able to pay off their house, or they're going to not be able to pay off their house at all.
The way I looked at it is two ways. One, if you're just in a normal age, let's say 20 to 55, you know, you're going to want to own a home, or put another way, if you're from 25 to 45, you're going to own a home because it gives you a lot of basic welfare. You know, the home ownership it has financial benefits, but also psychological benefits. You're not worried about a landlord or whether they'll raise money, raise the rent, and you'll have to move and that sort of thing. In that 25 to 55, say, the price really doesn't matter because if you have to sell at one point and buy another, it's like being on a tide. All the boats go up and all the boats go down. So if you sell at the low tide and buy, you're buying at the low tide and vice versa. Now, when you decide to either give it to your kids or to sell and set up your retirement, that's when you're much more sensitive to where you are in the tide. You want to sell at the high tide.
And also where you are with debt in general. Ricky, thank you so much.
Ah, thank you. Thanks very much, Beth.
Ricky Cassaday is a Hawaii real estate analyst and principal of Data at Work. We spoke about the analysis of consumer household debt by the Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism that placed Hawaii second in the nation.
I'm Kanila, Danny Kalikini.
And I'm Nicholas Kalikini.
And you're listening to The Conversation on Members-Supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Now we're going to get back to the backyard quiz. Earlier in the program, we asked if you knew at least two of the controversial judgments that Chief Justice William Richardson handed down between 1966 and 1982. Richardson may be best known for establishing the UH Manoa Law School, a cause he had supported for decades as a means of providing quality, affordable legal education for local residents. The University of Hawaii William S. Richardson Law School was named in his honor upon his retirement as Chief Justice in 1982. The judgments we asked you about centered on the use of land and natural resources, and they had a big impact on how Hawaii developed. You may be wondering why these decisions were controversial. Well, according to the history books, Richardson's believed the Western exclusivity concepts were not always consistent or applicable in Hawaii. And those aforementioned Richardson rulings were ensuring public access to beaches and affirming public ownership of water and other natural resources. A third judgment upheld traditional Hawaiian laws on access to kuleana lands. Those are the answers to today's quiz. Nobody got any of them, so we'll just keep our prize until tomorrow. But if you've got a backyard quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Theta healing is a practice that attempts to harness the energy of theta waves, one of the major frequencies of the brain. Theta waves take over during deep meditation or when we're drifting off to sleep, and to the devotee, they offer the key to both physical and mental health. Mira is a Maui instructor on theta healing who's putting together a course for instructors, and she's on the line. Hi, Mira.
Hi, Chris. How are you today?
Great. Thanks for talking with us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
If you would, give me sort of a capsule description of what this therapy is and how it works.
So, like you said, which was great, theta healing is it's actually a meditation training technique. It's basically using a spiritual philosophy, getting up to a theta brainwave to improve and help people evolve mind, body, and spirit. That's directly from the website. A woman named Vayana Stibal came up with this technique many years ago and started to work with all kinds of different people and discovered that by going into the theta state, she could actually co-create and help people to better their lives through discovering belief systems that weren't working for them and go in and change them. And actually what she says is she directly affects the DNA, helping people to evolve. So it's a fascinating technique. I'm actually not an instructor. I was bringing an instructor to come and teach this course.
Uh-huh.
A friend and I were both mothers wanting to learn this technique, use it for our families, use it for ourselves, open up a healing practice. And we interviewed many teachers to come out and decided on a woman out in Honolulu to come and teach a training course for us at the end of this month. So we've been having a great time meeting people here in Maui and coming up with people to join us, getting the word out about theta and just learning more about how to create a course.
Mira, when you talk about when the theta waves take over, how what does that feel like?
So myself personally, I've had many theta sessions. I lived in Thailand for many years, and there was an awesome theta healer over there that I would meet with. Basically, it's a deep sense of calm. So the practitioner will sit in front of you, sometimes hold your hand, and she'll go up into the theta state, and you can feel it through the person that's working with you. They'll see visualizations. They can do what's called body scan. They'll see energies that are dark or light, and they'll receive messages from Creator, basically saying if there's an imbalance. And what the person receiving the healing feels is a really just deep, calm, and relaxing state. And then often it works kind of like a workshop where they'll end up asking questions and you work together, and they always ask permission, you know, is it okay if I download a feeling, to the feeling of what it means to be successful, the feeling of unconditional love? What does it feel like to accept that? What is it... what is the highest definition of it? Let's give that to be your definition. It's a really amazing technique. I've really enjoyed receiving it myself over the years, and I'm really excited to learn to do it for myself and my family.
So when you go to see a theta practitioner, it sounds as if the practitioner has the ability to go into that state almost at mm-hmm. will.
Yeah, basically what they do is they learn and they'll give, when they're teaching, they give a guided meditation so that anybody can reach the theta state and be able to get into the creative abilities. And just through practice, they get into it faster and faster, and they are able to see more and more and be able to, I guess, I don't know if I would call it channeling or co-creating, kind of a combination of the two. Mm-hmm. So it's an intuitive healing ability.
Well,
and basically everybody can tap into it. It's just a matter of being initiated and practicing.
It sounds as if there's a certain amount of a kind of an extrasensory communication between the healer and mm-hmm. And the student, if you will.
Definitely.
Seems to be what you've gotten out of these sessions.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing. Basically, the healer has the ability to, through your permission, see into anything from an energetic imbalance to a past life issue. Oftentimes they'll work with you on, you know, oh, I think this is a karmic issue from many lives past, and then you kind of workshop with the healer to go through what the lesson was learned, release any traumas, release patterns that you've kept throughout your lives. And basically how it works is if you and the practitioner both have a belief in a higher power, whatever you choose to call it, it's non-denominational. If you have a belief in a higher power, that's what you're accessing, is that connection to your high beliefs and your faith, and the theta waves put you in a state of being able to access the ability to change energies, to heal yourself, to work on a multitude of things to improve health and spirit.
And this applies to physical health as well?
It does, actually. In Vianna Stibel's books, she writes many books about theta healing. She mentions being able to even heal broken bones. Myself, I don't know that that's what I'm looking for as a healer. I'm more into the energetic side, but it has applications on physical, mental, and energetic levels.
How long since you first were introduced to this healing method, Mira?
I was introduced to it about 8 years ago. A good friend of my husband is a master practitioner, and she had been visiting us in Thailand and had given a couple of sessions to the both of us, and had later organized to bring her teacher to take to teach courses, and then I was receiving healings from one of her students. So it's been about 8 years now that I've been really interested in this type of healing technique, and I moved to Maui about a year ago, and I thought this is the perfect place to do a training course.
It very likely is. Mira, yeah. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Sure. Mira is a student of Theta Healing on Maui, and to learn more about her upcoming practitioner course, you can visit our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Aloha, I'm Chris Tokumaru from the United States Department of Agriculture. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
There are always things going on around the state that we don't necessarily get to hear about, and that's where we turn to Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama, who joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Chris.
And one of these being a cultural animation film festival.
Right. It concludes tomorrow at the Doris Duke Theater. This inaugural festival showcases a unique collection of cultural-based animated films from around the world. We used to call them cartoons.
Yeah, I was just
when
gonna
we were
say
younger.
That, yeah.
Yeah. There's also a panel discussion. The goal of the festival is for cultural animators to share their work with other artists and audiences who would not normally have the opportunity to share their stories. For tomorrow's film schedule, visit HonoluluMuseum.org. Children 17 and under get free admission.
Derek, I suspect because they're called cultural animation, there's more to it than just cartoons.
Yeah, of course, of course.
But we'll just have to see.
Yes.
And then if you're on the Big Island and you haven't seen the latest Star Wars film, this is your opportunity.
Yes, for free. Tomorrow, the Kealakekua Public Library will screen Star Wars Rogue One. It's movie night, so bring the whole family. This film's rated PG-13. Popcorn will be served, and beverages in closed containers will be allowed. This didn't happen when I was a kid.
No,
it's in the Kealakekua Public Library at 4:30 p.m. tomorrow, and it's free.
And this next one is about an ancient Hawaiian game of strategy that I was not familiar with. This is also on Hawaii Island.
Yes, Konane is a game reminiscent of checkers and was once played throughout Hawaii. It has become popular again today and takes great thought and strategy to master. So test your skills against your friends. Learn how to play Konane tomorrow on the Kilauea Visitor Center Lanai from 10 a.m. to noon, and it's free.
Sounds like something to stimulate the brain.
Oh, yes. Yes, it does.
Thanks very much, Derek.
You're welcome, Chris.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa.
Next time on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll explore the opportunities and challenges of having nearly everything connected to the Internet.
What are the technical and even social implications of the Internet of Things?
That's next time on Bite Marks Cafe, Wednesday at 6:30 p.m.
That's going to do it for us for today. Of tomorrow, Neil Milner will be back with another Long View.
And we'll look ahead to Jazz Maui's East Meets West Festival.
You can comment about anything you hear on the program on our talkback line. That's 808-792-8217. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or on Twitter at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
And if you missed part of the conversation or any other show we air, you can find them on the new HPR app. Search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning with more of The Conversation.